Hi, I'm Nick.
And I'm Jess.
And this is Turn On Your Monitor, the podcast where, in the second season, we're talking about music documentaries. Before we get into today's topic, we kind of need to do a roundup from last time, because when we recorded our Some Kind of Monster episode, we both were not super familiar with... We were less familiar with Metallica's catalog, but... After recording that episode, I got a little curious as to what I was missing out on. So I listened to pretty much all of the early Metallica records up through the Black Album, as well as the first four Megadeth records. Which ones did you listen to?
I listened to the first Megadeth album, and I listened to all of the earlier Metallica, because I mean, my dad, I think I mentioned this, but like my dad back in the day bought a 6 CD changer.
Hell yeah.
And that was one of the first CDs he bought. Metallica Black Album was one of the first CDs he bought, along with, I think, AC/DC's Thunderstruck. So yeah, those were, we play those a lot. So I was like, you know, I'm familiar with that era of Metallica, but and I tried to go back and listen to earlier stuff, and I just never really got into it. But I did go back again, and I don't know. I kind of got Metallica pilled.
Yeah, I got to say, honestly, Ride the Lightning, actually very good. If you just kind of go into them, I kind of went into them with like, I'm going to listen to these and see what happens. Ride the Lightning, very good. That's actually probably now, I would say, is my favorite Metallica record.
Yeah, mine too. I really liked it, yeah.
Master of Puppets has a little bit, it's the songs start getting longer and it kind of drags a little bit for me, but overall very solid record. So I think that honestly, like the what equates to the Cliff Burton years, I actually really like the Cliff Burton years now, apparently.
Yeah.
So I definitely will go back and revisit those ones. And Justice for All is a little tricky because the production is awful, so that's kind of where they start to fall off for me.
Yeah.
But the first three records are great, and honestly, I had a little bit of frame of reference for Metallica. I had none for Megadeth. Honestly, surprising. I ended up really liking the early Megadeth stuff because I was expecting it to just kind of be Metallica-y, but it's sort of not. Mustaine, his vocal style is very different, and there's a lot more, to me, there's a lot more interesting lead guitar lines. Like, there's harmonized stuff. It's like very... you can tell that there's a very heavy new wave of British heavy metal influence on it. There's a lot of, like, you know, I can hear like Iron Maiden influence and a lot of stuff, which honestly for me made it pretty interesting. The first record in particular is kind of lo-fi, and it's kind of like they're playing faster than they should. It's a little messy in a way that actually I very much enjoy. So the first Megadeth record, gonna put a strong stamp of approval on that one. I actually really like that one. I don't know how often I will go back to all the stuff, but I definitely 100% will put on the first Megadeth record and Ride the Lightning again. Like when I'm in like a mood for when I'm in a mood for some thrash, those will be two that I go to for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah. So wanted to get that out there because when I was editing the episode, it was very much like, oh, we don't like Metallica. And then I'm like, I actually kind of do like Metallica a little bit now. And I'm like, I don't know anything about Megadeth. I'm like, yeah, Megadeth's actually kind of cool. So, yeah, so we kind of convinced ourselves that the 80s Megadeth and Metallica output is pretty cool. I get it now. I can't say that I understand later Metallica still. I'm still not a Saint Anger fan, but...
Yeah.
But, you know, give me the Cliff Burton years and I'll listen to it. So, with that out of the way, do we have any other housekeeping before we get into?
I don't think so.
All right. Would you like to introduce our movie of the week?
Okay.
The movie of the 2 weeks or 3 weeks, or however long this is between episodes.
Okay. This week, we're going to be talking about the documentary Dig!
From 2004.
Yes. Which is a documentary about, I don't know, how would you describe it? It's about two bands that start out as friends, become frenemies, and then maybe just enemies.
Yeah, interestingly enough, it also takes place kind of linearly across like 7 years. It was a long time in the making to film all the stuff. But the two bands in question are the Brian Jonestown Massacre and the Dandy Warhols, who, like you said, start out as friends who play together and are inspired by each other and sort of drift apart as in, I guess, traditional music narrative. One goes more commercial and one stays true to their underground roots.
Right. One band gets signed. It's almost a Goofus and Gallant type story.
Yeah, it's basically rock and roll Goofus and Gallant, which is that sort of reference people get? Like I
don't know.
I have a grab bag of references that I grew up with because my mom would always talk about really old stuff.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, this is very much Goofus and Gallant of rock and roll. What's the best thing to talk about first? Kind of the way, do you want to talk about the way that this is structured? Kind of the general trajectories of the two bands, or I kind of want to get the main story out of the way first and then kind of talk about all the little stuff.
Okay.
If I was going to summarize the plot of this film, it's basically this. In the mid 90s in West Coast, generally California, Oregon, at various points in time, there are these two bands, Brian Jonestown Massacre and Dandy Warhols. Both are kind of doing a retro thing. Both have kind of a 60s vibe. You know, there's a lot of like 60s Vox guitars, a lot of like K hollow bodies, you know, a lot of the kind of stuff that a band of that type at the time would be able to, you know, afford and play back when, you know, you could buy those things for pretty cheap, but like very, very kind of influenced by late 60s psychedelic rock, that kind of thing. And at the start of the documentary, I guess we'll get into the specifics later, but basically the trajectory of the two bands is that they're playing, they play shows together, so on and so forth. The Dandy Warhols kind of start to take off. They get a major record label deal and they record a couple records, and the Brian Jonestown Massacre, for various mostly personal reasons, and they remain unsigned. They're one where there's a lot of label interest and people are like, this band's really good. However, they're kind of a nightmare. A lot of record labels are not willing to take the chance. So Dandy Warhols, you know, put a couple records out. They're kind of a little disheartened because they have this big label deal, but nothing's really happening. They're not popping off.
Right. It's like even the Gallant band kind of gets screwed over by the industry.
Eventually, by the end, they take off. They have a couple songs that pop off, and they become a fairly, at the time, pretty big band. You know, they end up selling a lot of records. They're playing huge festivals, and that's kind of where the documentary leaves them, is sort of...
Things are looking up for the old Dandy Warhols.
I would argue that the documentary, at the point it cuts off, is probably at the peak of when the Dandy Warhols were, like, famous.
Yeah.
Because also, we'll talk about the legacy of these two bands at a later point, but I think culturally, Dandy Warhol's kind of high-key fall off between now and then.
Yeah.
Whereas Brian Jonestown Massacre, they were the underdogs who kind of have become more popular in recent years. But yeah, so that's the Dandy Warhol's trajectory. They get signed, they struggle a little bit, and then they kind of pop off. Whereas the Brian Jonestown Massacre is... There's a lot more of a rocky story. Nobody really wants to sign them. They eventually do get signed with a kind of a bigger indie label, TVT Records, who I think also they were the ones that put out the bad late 90s and early 2000s Guided by Voices records when they decided to try to make them hi-fi for some reason. So, but they put out a record and then they part ways. They get either dropped or they decide that they both are like, we shouldn't do this anymore. And then, as far as I know, Brian Jonestown Massacre have just been like completely independent since then. Like Anton releases the stuff on, like, he runs his own label. Like they've been like very much a like DIY, no support from anybody. We're just going to do this band since day one. And, you know, that's kind of how the documentary goes. It just is like, yeah, this kind of doesn't work out. But when it leaves the Brian Jonestown Massacre at the end, it's kind of like stuff really hasn't worked out for them so far.
Yeah.
And there's almost kind of like a if you contrast the what Anton says at the beginning versus the end, there's kind of this like bittersweet thing where at the beginning he's like, we're going to revolutionize music. And then at the end, he's kind of like, there's a whole bunch of bands popping off that are just ripping off what I'm doing. Like, I was there first. So yeah, that's kind of what it is. And it just follows 7 years in the lives of these two bands. The reason that that's sort of interesting is not really related to the overall story it's telling, but rather like the personalities in the bands and how this all plays out. So now that the big story's out of the way, I don't think that there's really a big overarching thesis or like lesson from it. I think it's really just kind of like, I think that the value of this is, which is, I really enjoy this documentary. This is one that I really like. I think that the value comes from just kind of like being a fly on the wall over bands interacting in the music industry and stuff like that. But I think to properly explain what makes this documentary, I think we need to explain the two main characters.
Okay.
Yeah. So how would you describe? So basically this centers around basically the front man of the Dandy Warhols, Courtney Taylor Taylor.
Yes. Courtney Taylor Taylor.
Wait, I always forget. Did we find out if that was that's a fake name, right?
I think his name is Taylor, just one Taylor.
But he's like, what if I added a second?
I know.
Let's see. Yeah, Courtney A. Taylor, known as Courtney Taylor Taylor. Yeah, so the Dandy Warhols frontman, Courtney Taylor Taylor, is kind of driving the Dandy Warhol segments, but he's also the narrator of the documentary. Like,
yeah.
So
also, I think I'm. I don't know if it was said in the documentary or if it's just something I read later. I think there was actually more footage of like the person filming this had more footage of the Dandies. Like, it was more like they were more embedded in with the Dandies, and I think did follow them for 7 years. And I think they were less involved with Brian Jonestown Massacre.
I don't think you could follow. I don't think you could embed.
Yeah.
You couldn't embed with that unit for seven years.
Yeah, Courtney Taylor Taylor. Should we describe what Courtney Taylor Taylor is like?
Yeah, well, first I want to say that he basically is narrating this. So during the Dandy Warhols parts, he's first person narrating it. But also during the Brian Jonestown parts, he's kind of narrating what's going on with them. So he's kind of the voice that drives this. But yeah, go give your Courtney Taylor Taylor impressions.
I didn't like him.
He doesn't come across as very likable in the documentary, I gotta say.
Yeah. Also, one of the problems I had with this watching this documentary is that every time he is on camera, his hair is different. So every time I was like, who is this? And I was like, okay, it's Courtney Taylor Taylor again.
Yeah, because it'll cut to him and like he'll just randomly like have a slicked back mohawk out of
nowhere.
I
get it. They're filming this over 7 years, so you're going to have different hairstyles. But it's like
radically
different hairstyles.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. Like every time they cut to him, he's just like laying on a couch somewhere with like a different hairstyle.
There is a point where he is talking about how functional he and his band are and that they all of their parents are still together. And I just found that like I hated him.
He's like, we're the most well-adjusted rock band ever. And they're like, all our parents are still together. And there's one part later where he's like, if you're a musician, there's like three things, like you could have like a car, a house or something, but never like all three. But he's like, yeah, we have all those. Like, we're doing pretty well. And
you can ever. Yeah.
Oh, and I think it's like a car, a spouse, and a house.
House,
and it's like,
yeah, they all have, yeah.
It's like, we're all happily married and everything's going well and we're well-adjusted, which is, we'll get to in a second, a funny contrast with Brian Jonestown Massacre. But I will say that in the time since this documentary, both bands have kind of denounced it.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, obviously Anton hates it.
Yeah, well, I mean,
which is, yeah, he's
you'd expect.
Gonna.
Yeah.
But yeah, even members of the Dandies have kind of said they wouldn't have made the same choices. I don't know if they've denounced it, but they were kind of like, yeah, this isn't really what I would have.
Yeah. And we'll get to it later. But I think that both of them have kind of said that, like,
it's not terribly accurate.
Yeah, it's not terribly accurate. And a lot of the stuff that kind of gets played up as being a big deal was sort of more of an inside joke or like something that's not like the stuff of like Anton stalking the Dandies was like not real.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so that's one half of this is the Dandy Warhols, their rise to success. Courtney Taylor Taylor narrating. I will say before we leave Courtney, there's a funny bit where the photographer who does their first like big music video, what's that guy's name?
David LaChapelle.
Yeah, he's like we're doing this whole shoot, and Courtney's like, now can we go back and reshoot this because I don't like my hair, and he's like I didn't do anything, it's just natural lighting. He's like, you don't like your face, that's what your face looks like. And Courtney's having this big like, I hate this video, it's not working, like I don't want my like. He's having this like diva moment. He didn't like
how his face looked in it.
Yeah, he's like, can I grow my hair out a little longer? He's having this diva moment over how he looks in a music video. Which yeah. For me, that's the part that sticks in my head of like, okay, like who is Courtney Taylor Taylor?
Yes.
Now the flip side, Anton Newcombe of the Brian Jonestown Massacre. How would you describe Anton to someone who is unfamiliar?
Like, I don't know, just the biggest mess. Like a kind of stereotypical, like musical genius guy who is an addict and mentally ill.
Yeah, like complete inability to like function a normal life, but like very driven. One of those guys that just has like a never ending stream of ideas. Like, because the documentary talks about it fairly frequently, but like the early years of the Brian Jonestown Massacre, the output is absurd. Like they're dropping like 3 or 4 full length records a year. And like a full length Brian Jonestown record is like over an hour long. Like they're not, mm-hmm. you know, they're prolific. And like, you know, Anton's like, yeah, I recorded Thank God for Mental Illness and for $17. It's like, go watch. He's like, tag along. We're going to record a record now. And it's like, they scam some studio time. And then like a week, they have another hour long record. Like they just go into the studio and like an hour long record pops out. So, definitely prolific. I think that Anton suffers from the same thing that a lot of prolific people do, where I think you could do a little bit better editing wise. You know, like yeah. I think that Brian Jonestown Massacre at the peak is brilliant, but like when they're slightly off of the peak, there's like, it's like, I think you could cut a little bit of this.
Also, he's not the kind of guy that you can tell this idea isn't great.
Yeah, he's not the kind of person you can sit down and have like a normal like, let's talk about this like it's business. Like he's very much like this is like the most important thing and this is my art, and like
he's also that. So uncompromising about the business aspect. Like he's so obsessed with not getting screwed by a record company that he's like turning down probably good offers.
Yeah, because they have over the course of it, they have several A&R people who are like, like, yeah, we went to a show and I love this and I want to sign them, but like this is a big task. Cause then they'd be like, oh, this band is great. We haven't talked yet about one of the defining characteristics of Brian Jonestown, but they'd be like, oh, this is great, I'm gonna bring somebody else from the label to see them. And then they'd bring him to a Brian Jonestown Massacre show, which was like 2 songs, and then the show ends because the band gets into a fist fight on stage and they're like, we cannot sign this band, this is going to be a disaster to get this band on our label under contract. So it's like they're continually just like shooting themselves in the foot. It's become kind of it's become a staple of like people go to a Brian Jonestown Massacre show. Even now, like the tour they're on right now, like there's footage on YouTube from like a few days ago of like Anton yelling at like, they're like, oh, he stopped the show twice to yell at the drummer. Like he's still,
oh my God.
Yeah. Even at like, I mean, fuck, how old's Anton now? Like 60 or something. Like they're still getting in fights on stage. Like that's what the band is. But, and the documentary captures several like actual, like physical altercations on stage.
Yeah.
That's kind of what made it so difficult. And like, there are Brian Jonestown Massacre fans who are like, that's what they love. And like, they want, Their ideal set is that the band gets into a fight on stage. Like that's what they want. And then some people are annoyed by it. Some people are like, I don't care about this band because that's just annoying. But yeah, these A&R people would be like, this band is great. You know, these records are great. You know, take somebody from the label to see them, and then it would just be a shit show. And the labels are like, we can't touch this. This is not the band you want to be dealing with in business meetings.
Right.
Anton's very, he's got a prickly persona. He's kind of hard to. It's kind of hard to relate to even now, like his Twitter account, like he will go off and he has a short fuse. He's not like a super, I don't think he doesn't seem like a very easy person to get along with. Like he's kind of a, like there are people who have like seen this documentary and be like, yeah, I won't listen to that band just because Anton seems like a jerk. Like, I just don't care.
Right. Now, I feel like I know this is going to sound crazy, but I felt more sympathy for him than maybe I should.
I think the thing that makes me really connect with Anton in this is that I understand him. Like I fully understand him. But I totally relate to like being obsessively drawn to things at the expense of like being able to function in your normal life.
Right. A part where somebody says this is the only thing that Anton could do. And you really do believe that. Like, he can't function in society.
Yeah, there's really nothing else. And for that reason, like, I do very much, like, I relate to him and I understand him, and like, I get it. Like, I get that there's no plan B for him. Like, he's just doing the only thing he can do. Whereas like in the Dandy Warhols, if they break up, you know, in the middle of this, like, they're going to be fine. They're well adjusted and functional, as they've said. But like, yeah, Anton's just such a weird guy who doesn't really have like, he doesn't really have anything else he could be doing. Like, if it's not for, you know, recording 4 albums a year, what else is he going to be doing? So while he's not the easiest to get along with him, I do agree that like of him and Courtney, he's the one that like I get, because I also feel like Anton's going to be an asshole to you directly, and he's not going to stab you in the back.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know, the Dandy Warhols are just like, they're very calculated.
There's
like
something kind of disingenuous about Courtney Taylor, or that's how he comes across. You know, he might not be like that in real life, but in the documentary, he does kind of come across as like a guy who might screw you over to get more success.
Because there's this goal in mind, which is like music industry success.
Yeah.
Whereas with Anton, the goal in mind is always like, I want to finish this record and have it sound good. Where there's not as much of a, because like if Anton wanted to sell out and make money, he could have done so. He had people that were trying to get him to do that, and he just wouldn't compromise. So in terms of that point, I did watch Premier Guitar did a rig rundown with the Dandy Warhols, like this tour, like maybe like a month ago or something. And all the members of the band came across as pretty nice. Like, they're probably fine people. Maybe being older, they've kind of maybe being older and successful, they've kind of mellowed out from whatever that energy is where you're a band trying to make it. And maybe the documentary does, like, maybe it is kind of deliberately trying to portray them a certain way that wasn't super accurate. So, I mean, they're probably fine people, but just in terms of like what this documentary is presenting them as, they kind of come across, I don't know, because it also is like every time they show Brian Jonestown Massacre having something bad happen, they cut to the Dandy Warhols being like, oh, we're so fortunate that didn't happen to us. Because Brian Jonestown Massacre is, they're doing like their first national tour, and they're somewhere in Georgia, and they get pulled over and like busted with weed, and it's like a whole thing, like the whole thing falls apart and all this stuff. And then it cuts to like the Dandy Warhols in Europe, where like the French police find weed on them, and they're like, oh, don't do this again. We'll your penalty be double. And then Courtney's like, I mean, they gave us a fine of like $50, and they didn't even take the weed.
Yeah, they didn't take the weed. Yeah.
So he's like, oh, we're so fortunate, much more fortunate than Brian Jonestown Massacre. So it's like the way it's edited, it kind of keeps giving you that like Brian Jonestown Massacre like fucks something up, and then the Dandy Warhols are like, oh, nothing bad can happen to us. Like, oh, we just got a little slap on the wrist, and nothing bad happened to us. Like, I think he said, like, he didn't say how much, but he said the fine was like 4 Dandy Warhols t-shirts worth. It was like, it was like what could that have been at the time? Like, less than $100 fine. And like, they didn't even confiscate the drugs. But yeah, that's kind of how this goes. So you kind of like, I don't know, you're kind of like, oh, these guys are just like too squeaky clean, and they're bugging me. And then like, it just keeps cutting the talking heads with the Dandy Warhols, where they're like, oh, we're just so fortunate that the band is good and we're friends and everything's going great. And then it cuts to like, Anton's parents talking about how much of a fuck up he is.
Oh, I hated Anton's parents. Well, not his, I mean, his dad was an alcoholic, and he seems to have a lot of remorse. for how he was, but like, yeah, I felt bad. Like, he clearly had a terrible upbringing.
Yeah.
And his mom just doesn't seem like a nice person.
Yeah, I don't get the idea that he had a lot of support coming from that arena. Definitely not well adjusted.
Yeah,
to put it that way.
So yeah, you're kind of like, oh, I see why he turned out the way he did.
Yeah, I think that pretty much takes care of like the main arc, and that's kind of the two main people that this focuses on. Because the other Danny Warhol members are kind of just like, they're kind of there. And they don't ever fight with Courtney, so they're kind of not really characters. On the Brian Jonestown side, Matt Hollywood is a bit of a character in butting heads with Anton a bit.
He's sort of portrayed as like the Salieri to Anton's Mozart.
Yeah.
Because it's like he can write, he has talent, but like he's not quite on the level of Anton.
Yeah, there's a bit where they're like, yeah, he's not quite Anton level. So Matt Hollywood's kind of a foil for Anton in here. He was in the band a long time. You know, he quit for a while.
You think back, he rejoined?
Rejoined, yeah. I mean, at one point, Brian Jonestown Massacre is very much one of those bands, like Guided by Voices I mentioned, where there's a ton of lineups, and you know, Anton at various points has like fired everybody and replaced them all. So there's I'm gonna look at the Wikipedia and see if there's a list of everybody who's been in there. There's been a ton, because like also Will Carruthers, who played bass in Spaceman 3, like late in their career, like circa, I think Playing with Fire era, Spaceman 3. Will Carruthers was in Brian Jonestown Massacre a little bit.
Oh wow!
Like everybody's been in Brian Jonestown Massacre. Let me check the. Members: Anton Newcombe, Colin Hegna, Ricky Mamie, Ryan Van Crete. Past members, former members, there's just a link to click to it because there's so many people. Comprehensive lineup history. There's like a spreadsheet of every lineup. So yeah, there's been a lot of people in Brian Jonestown Massacre, and it's one of those bands where the only consistent member has been the main guy, Anton. So yeah, Matt Hollywood's kind of he's the more reasonable one. He's the one who, when Anton storms off, he's talking to the camera of like, he's being unreasonable. Like he's afraid that he's going to get scammed by all these record labels, but then he's turning around and he's trying to figure out how he can scam the record labels. He's kind of, you know, acting like a baby about things. Like he's the more level-headed one who's got a better handle on like how the stuff actually works. And like, trying to sort of take care of the business side of things. And it's also important to note that their one record that was on kind of a bigger indie label, the one we were talking about when they went to TBT for Strung Out in Heaven, that was actually at the height of Anton's addiction. So, which probably led to the fact that the record contract kind of fell through. But that's actually the record where Matt Hollywood picks up a lot more slack on it, because Anton was kind of not able to. Weirdly enough, after being so prolific, they finally get the deal once Anton's a little bit unable to actually perform up to his normal standard. So actually a couple songs on that record are revisits of ones they'd previously recorded. Matt Hollywood picks up some slack and does more writing on there than normal, just because Anton's kind of out of it. So weirdly enough, their quote unquote biggest release, Anton actually is kind of like not fully able to get his shit together. And so Matt does have to step up, and he does have to sort of be the responsible one who makes that project actually happen. Also, I think they mentioned that the dynamic between Anton and Matt is very much kind of like a big brother, little brother thing.
Yeah.
Which is why I think that the onstage fights are so kind of aggressive. Like it does have that energy, but it's also very like, I don't know, like, I guess when their egos clash, and then I think the point where he quits is in there, like they get into a confrontation on stage.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And Matt Hollywood just like, he walks off. He's like, I'm done with this.
Boy fights.
Yeah. It do be like that. So, yeah. So I would say that he's probably an important character, as to sort of contrast, with Anton. The other guys in the band get some screen time to kind of ground some of the weirdness that's going on around them. But one thing I do want to talk about is the... Is there anything specifically you want to talk about while I'm trying to remember? Yeah, I just had a thing I wanted to talk about, but I kind of blanked on it. Because I do want to later talk about 13 Tales of Urban Bohemia.
Yeah, I want to talk about, like, you know, I guess legacies, and I want to talk about, like, just our opinions about their...
I want that to be the end. There was a very specific thing I was thinking of, though.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that music video.
Yeah, I want to talk about the music video, and I want to talk about the photo shoot at the...
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah. So when Brian Jonestown Massacre gets a little bit of money from that record deal, they basically move everybody to a house in the LA area, I believe, because they were kind of a little transient. And like at one point, Anton's like up in Portland trying to like crash with the Dandies and all kinds of stuff. But eventually they get a house, which is very much like, it literally is like, there's nothing in there. It's just a barren house with like amplifiers and guitars laying around.
Yeah. And like a mattress.
Yeah. It's like, it's very much like mattress, guitar. That's it. I think somebody in one of the Talking Heads compares it to like a, I keep saying Talking Heads as in documentary Talking Heads, not that there's a band member of the Talking Heads. But I think one of the people like compares it to like a crack den or something. Like you just kind of go in there.
And yeah.
There's nothing.
And a squat basically. Yeah.
Which, to be fair, it kind of was, I mean, like,
yeah.
But yeah, so the Dandy Warhols, they get this idea to do a photo shoot, and they're like, let's go to the Brian Jonestown Massacre's house to do a photo shoot. And they came up with this like ridiculously cornball idea of like, yeah, the idea is that like every day the Dandy Warhols wake up in a different band's house. And it's like, okay, first of all, that's the lamest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
The Brian Jonestown Massacre is like, these guys are coming in here to act like they party. And this is like, they're coming to our house to act like they live like no, we live like this. What are you doing?
Right. Yeah. It does feel like they want to steal some valor. They're trying to steal junkie valor.
It's stealing junkie burnout valor. Cause like the Dandy Warhols are like, they're like posing and like mugging for the camera and like the mirror and stuff. And it's like, come on, you guys are well adjusted. You're not living in the heroin house with no furniture. Come on.
Yeah.
So
it seems to me like it's a contrast between a coke band and a heroin band.
Yeah. Have I ever gone into my in-depth my drug band theory thing?
I don't think so.
So I think that there are like very definitive stages of rock music that are fueled by various drugs. Cause like the early rock and roll stuff, I mean, like the Beatles and Hamburg, they were on uppers, like amphetamines were like a very, very important part of like the early mid-60s stuff. Like in my head, like the first Who record, that's an amphetamine record. And like, whether or not they were like literally on things, like that's an amphetamine record. Everybody's like, we got to play fast. Like that energy that comes out of there, that's like an amphetamine energy. And then you get the late 60s is all the psychedelics, and then the 70s is just like a coke decade, and then like 80s is a coke decade in a different way. And then there's like, then you have like, then there's like the offshoot of heroin music, like
the early 90s.
Yeah. But yeah, so I weirdly enough, I think the Brian Jonestown Massacre, they make a lot of like psychedelic music,
mm-hmm.
kind of, but it doesn't, they don't strike me as a psychedelic band, like a psychedelics band. Like they're not like an acid band.
No.
They sound like a heroin band to me.
Yeah.
It's very much like kind of like heroin chic. They got the heroin element of the Velvet Underground and like the kind of, I know that Anton doesn't like post Brian Jones Stones. I know that he doesn't like when they kick Brian Jones out of the band.
Yeah.
But that super heroined out late 60s, early 70s Stones vibe, I get from them a lot, which is also another heroin band, is the late 60s, early 70s Stones.
Right.
A lot of that like rock and roll revival type stuff is very heroiny.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably, Spoken as a podcast who's never done heroin.
Yeah. I hope you never do.
we're going to, one of our Patreon stretch goals is we're going to, from the steroid episode at one Patreon point, we start doing steroids and we get huge. And then Actually, this is the, we're gonna call this the Trent Reznor stack, where at one Patreon tier we start doing steroids, and then we go a bit further, and then we start doing heroin.
Yeah, heroin really does seem like a drug that does make you better at music, but there is a point where then it destroys your life.
Oh, I mean, going back to what I was saying, I think for the longest time, I was like very resistant to 70s music. And I just had this idea that like just Coke bands were just like dog shit. Like that was where you get ridiculously self-indulgent 70s guitar solos. That was, yeah. I mean, like fucking Clapton, like that was in my head. Like, it's like, okay,
start doing cocaine. Clapton, to be fair, was a heroin guy.
Yeah, but when he was on heroin, he was just watching TV. He wasn't like doing anything besides watch. Like, if you're going to just do heroin and watch cartoons and not make records, like, I mean, fine. You do you, Clapton. But yeah, so to circle back around, the Dandies are kind of trying to steal Junkie Valor. Meanwhile, their first single that they try to push is Not If You Were the Last Junkie on Earth, which was kind of it's framed as being a dig on Anton.
Right. Well, yeah, he excitedly plays it for Anton. Is like, we've got a, like, I've written this hit.
This is going to be a hit, yeah.
Yeah, this is going to be our first hit.
He's like, and Anton didn't respond. And it just shows that Anton just like sitting there completely unfazed, like not paying attention. Which, I mean, so here's the thing. I really was not familiar with much of the Dandy Warhol's music before watching this. There is a skate video called Blind made a video called What If that I believe has two Dandy Warhol songs on the soundtrack. If not, it has one, and there's one on a different skate video. Those are the only Dandy Warhol songs I'd ever heard before this. Like, they don't pop up in my daily life, but I'd never heard Not If You Were the Last Junkie on Earth.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that song?
Honestly, it is an earworm. I actually do think it is an earworm, but it's kind of one of those earworms that's irritating.
Maybe it's a testament to it not being an earworm for me. I'm trying to remember the melody. What?
I never thought you'd be a junkie
because heroin is so passe. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really do it for me, but also it's really cringy. Like, so here's the thing. Like, we'll talk about it later when we talk about the legacy, but like, the Dandy Warhols are probably the most, I can't think of a single band that is more tied to that era than Dandy Warhols. Like,
yeah,
everything in this is like, the Dandy Warhols cannot exist beyond the early 2000s. Like, it's like the late 90s, early 2000s vision of like what a hipster is, what cool is. Like, it's so cemented in that era that when you watch this stuff now, you're like, wow, this is, at one point this was cool, I guess.
Yeah. It was not a hit, right? This did not.
No, it didn't end up being a hit. Like, they were like, this is gonna be a hit, and then it kind of doesn't.
Record label does pay David LaChapelle $400,000 to direct a video.
Yeah, which I pulled out the old inflation calculator when I was watching this, and like, in today's money, that's a $750,000 video for that, yeah, for a single that doesn't really go anywhere. And what's funny is while they're filming that, side note, what one thing that's funny is that when people uploaded stuff to YouTube in the early version of the site, when things had to be low res, so Capitol uploaded that video in the early days of YouTube, and like the highest resolution you can watch it is like 240p. So it's an almost adjusted for inflation, an almost $1 million video, and like you can only watch it in like VHS tier quality, which is kind of interesting to me. But yeah, so they spend all this money on this video, and like the Dandies are like, this doesn't really seem like it's kind of weird, because it really isn't a good fit for them, because it's very, mm-hmm, like, it's a bunch of like 80s stuff, and like they're a band that's trying to mine the 60s.
Yeah.
And the Brian Jonestown Massacre guys show up on the set, and they're like, what is this shit? And they're like making fun of it as it's going on. They're like, I guess that this is, oh, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on that's, don't you see, it's passé. Everything's passé. That's the theme. Because the lyrics say passé. And like they're kind of mocking the fact that, like, I mean, $400,000 on that video. Like, that's for a band that like has not had a hit yet. Like, some of the label people get into it when they're talking about it, where they're like, they're like, hey, you know, Brian Jones and Massacre, like, they're recording these albums for basically no money and they're really great. You can just like, a label can just like put these out. But like, what other industry can you be in where a 90% failure rate is good? Like,
right. I think that was the A&R guy for TVT saying that.
Yeah. Whereas like, he's like, the 10% that make it, they carry all the 90% of failure. Like, what other industry is that okay? And it kind of gets into like how broken the music industry is, which I would imagine if you made something like this closer to today, it would be even more insane with, you know, with the advent of streaming and all, and like the label deals that are going on now. I'm sure it's like 20 times worse than it was back then. But even then it was like, okay, you sign the Dandies, you throw all this money at them and they don't even have a hit yet. And then the Dandy Warhols are feeling like the label is like not supporting them, because they're like, if you don't have a hit instantly, like, we don't care about you because you need,
right, they pour this insane amount of money into a video and into this other stuff, but if you don't take off instantly, if it doesn't work that second, they're like, well, fuck it, we tried, it's not happening, we got to move on, we sunk all this money into this and we just got to cut and run at this point. They're basically like, oh, you didn't make us the $400,000 back, so fuck you.
Although it is funny, while they're recording the first record, somebody at Capitol hears it and they're like, I don't think there's a hit on here. And Courtney Taylor says, I sneeze and hits come out. And then what did the label guy? The label guy like shut him down. What did he say after that?
I forget. Oh, I wish I could remember that.
Fuck, it's such a good line. But he's like, I sneeze and hits comes out. And it's like, dude, you have not had a hit yet. You can't do that. Like, you're not.
Yeah. You're,
you know, it's one thing if, like, you know, you're like Bowie in the late 80s and the labels give you shit and you're like, you know how many fucking hits I've had? Like, right. Okay, yeah, he's had a lot of hits. Like, you can't do that. But like Courtney Taylor, you haven't had any hits. You can't do that. You can't be the pompous rock star guy if you haven't quote unquote made it yet. So I thought that was very funny. There's a moment near the middle where before they really pop off, where you really get a sense of vulnerability from him, where he's like, I can't get, like, I'm calling people, like, nobody at the label will pick up. And it's like, you know, and you get signed and they're like, hey, we're not in this for hits, we're in this for careers. And then you get signed, and if you don't have a hit, they don't care about your career.
Yeah.
And like, he's very much seeing like the underbelly of the record industry while, you know, Brian Jones had Massacre's off, like, doing heroin or whatever they're doing, yeah, at the time.
And, fighting
and Anton's riding around on roller skates, giving out records of their response song, Not If You Were the Last Dandy on Earth.
Yeah.
Which another thing that I think that the documentary like kind of elides is that Anton didn't even write, like, that's a Matt Hollywood song. Like,
it, Anton, is Matt, yeah, it is, yeah. A Matt Hollywood song.
Anton didn't write that one, but they kind of play it off like Anton did, because like there's a kind of rivalry
at this point.
Like, they mention that Anton wants to get a kind of like Blur Oasis style rivalry, where it's like, hey, if our two bands are fighting, then we get publicity for both of us.
Right.
And then the, you know, the Dandies are kind of like, well, you know, neither of us is really big enough to do a
Blur Oasis thing. Right. Yeah. To be fair, I think it's not a bad idea, but I get that, like, yeah, you're not, no one cares about you enough to get involved, yeah, in this.
Yeah. So I think they kind of play it off like Anton stalking them more than he really was. Like, I think he said that was just kind of like, he was playing it up for the camera, like, to have a plot point. And then
there's a point where he sends him a bullet. Anton, yeah, he sends Courtney a bullet.
He sends one with like the band members' names on it. You open up and it's like a shotgun shell or something. Yeah, so I think that he said that was kind of played up. I think they both said that was kind of played up, and it was never. The documentary kind of makes it seem like, oh, is Anton going to do something crazy, when I don't think anyone was really thinking he was going, yeah, to.
Right, and even the, you know, some of the foundation of the rivalry is like the Dandies come out with Not If You Were the Last Junkie on Earth, and it's sort of assumed to be about Anton. But Courtney Taylor has said that it is actually about an ex-girlfriend he had who got addicted to heroin while he was on tour.
Oh, I didn't read that. Because the common thing everybody says is, oh, it's a dig at Anton.
I mean, it seems like it would be a dig at Anton, and I would be surprised if it wasn't still kind of a dig at Anton too. I mean, if this is about a person you once loved and who was your girlfriend, it's like an extremely heartless song
to write. Yeah, it's also like, it has such a weird vibe to it, where it's like, it's like, hey, instead of doing heroin, why don't you do other stuff that cool young people think is cool? There's a line that's like,
there's something about why didn't you pretend to be gay?
Yeah, it's like, and decide that maybe that you were gay either way. I never thought you'd be a junkie because heroin is so passe. It's just like the whole, like all the verses are just like mega cringy, which is kind of a running theme with Mandy Warhol's lyrics.
And then so the response, the song, Not If You Were the Last Dandy on Earth, I think Matt has also said it wasn't meant to be like a diss.
The documentary was kind of like trying to make this beef into being a beef when it wasn't really.
Yeah.
I think the band's probably drifted apart just because of career. There's a part where like around the time that Anton gets his home studio and they're recording, he's like, oh, like what's Courtney up to? I haven't seen that guy in forever. I probably won't ever again, unless there's like some label thing where they're like, they put us on the same bill or something. Like he's kind of like, we're kind of in different places and like, we can't really be friends as much just because of life. Right. More so than like, oh, we're butting heads. It's a rivalry.
I mean, I can imagine that there is somewhat of a rivalry because, as Morrissey said, we hate it when our friends become successful.
We do. Morrissey has also said a lot of
things. I'm not going to talk about other things Morrissey has said.
Is there a Morrissey documentary by any chance?
There's got to be. Yeah.
It feels like somebody has to have done something, which would be very interesting because. If there's one guy who had his legacy in the bag and then threw it away, it's that guy. Yeah.
Should we talk about when the dandies actually do kind of blow up?
Yeah, I was looking at the Last Junkie lyrics. I could say, shouldn't you have got a couple piercings and decided maybe that you were gay in a way? I can't help but feel responsible. I always knew that you were insane with your pain, but I never thought you'd be a junkie because heroin is so fast. If you're talking about it being about a girlfriend, it's very weird.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's like, I didn't think you'd do this. Also you're crazy. And, this is pretty cringe that you're on heroin now.
It seems like the lyrics fit more if it is about Anton. It seems more like a song you would write about a friend who you also kind of resent and think is full of shit.
Yeah. There is a part near the end where Anton's like, yeah, the first Dandies record is great. I used to love them and now their songs are kind of shit. And he starts quoting the lyrics to Minnesota.
Yeah.
Which, once again, I was unfamiliar with the song, but yeah, I could rock her like a doctor if I found a way to get her off first. I could own her, the crazy loner, if I found my way to Minnesota. In a slumber, I'm sawing lumber. I saw my baby dance a Latin number with her shirt off. Man, her skin soft, but in a mood she'd rather if I jerked off. If I found my way to Minnesota, Minnesota, oh yeah. And then you repeat the first verse and chorus. And like, that's, he's like mocking.
Sub-ketus level.
Yeah, he's like mocking it. It's like shit. Yeah. Like, fuck, was I too hard on Kiedis? Because Kiedis at least can sometimes have bars.
Yeah.
Bob Marley, poet and a prophet. Bob Marley, show me how to offer in your door, little dancing in your drink a little water.
Like, this is not, because Taylor doesn't have that Kiedis flow.
He doesn't, no.
So, which I guess will take us to the moment that the Dandy Warhols blow up is with the delightfully titled record, 13 Tales of Urban Bohemia. Which is like,
I'm eager to hear your thoughts about this album.
Okay, so the first time that I watched this, the fact that that was the name of the record totally slipped by me. And then the second time, I was like, fuck, they really called it that. That's like calling your record like the hipster record or something. Like, are you serious right now? But the way that they blow up is actually that like a European phone company uses one of their songs in its ad, and that's how they blow up.
Everyone's song like, oh. Bohemian Like You.
They're like, oh, this Bohemian Like You song from the phone commercial is cool.
So they become huge in Europe.
They become huge in Europe off of a phone commercial because everyone's like,
and like, yeah, nothing in the States.
I like to call people on the phone. Yeah, that's a cool thing for young people. And I guess it eventually catches up more. I get the sense that they've always been more popular in Europe. Mm-hmm. But like, Bohemian Like You also sucks. Like, it's not like none of the Dandy Warhol stuff speaks to me, and like none of it seems good to me. Like, I just don't like it.
I think it is catchy. Like, I think the song is catchy. I'm not necessarily saying it's good, but I see why it was used in a phone commercial and blew up.
It's phone commercial music, yeah, for sure. But here's the thing, like, kind of a Courtney Taylor-esque, like, I sneeze and hits come out thing. Like, mm-hmm, there's so many fucking catchy songs out there. Like, catchy does shit.
He sneezes in phone commercials.
Yeah, he does. But yeah, so Bohemian Like You, it's like, it feels like if somebody, like, if you sat down a bunch of, like, 45-year-old professional class people in a focus group and like, what do these young hip people think is cool? And like, you wrote down a list and you're like, there's our next song. Cause the whole thing is like, yeah, if you dig on vegan food, cause I work at a restaurant and wait tables and we all have bands and cause we live in the city. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I guess this is like the most cliche. Cause it kind of feels like one of those things where like, I think that the whole, I'm glad that as a society we've stopped using the word hipster because it was really fucking annoying like 20 years. But like the whole point of like the whole hipster thing was like you weren't supposed to like admit to being a hipster, which was like the least cool thing you could do was to try to admit to being a hipster. Like if you were trying to be a hipster, you were. But like all these songs are like, yeah, I'm a hipster and I'm cool and I do the things that are cool. Cause like this thing is like, yeah, I really love your hairdo. Yeah, I'm glad you like mine too. See, we're looking pretty cool. So what do you do? Oh yeah, I wait tables too. And now I haven't heard your band because you guys are pretty new. But if you dig on vegan food, we'll come over to my work. I'll have them cook you something that you really love. And it's like, I don't know. It's like you're just singing about like waiting tables and with a cool haircut. And it's like, I don't. Like, I get it. I get that you did a record. Like, I guess the record is, like, I'm assuming, based on the title, I'm assuming it's 13 songs that are all kind of about this set of, like, cool urban people in, like, the year 2000-ish.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel, like, important enough to be writing a song about. And, like, I get why it became a phone commercial, because they're like, young people will love this. It's cool. Cool young people will love the cool young people song. But, like, doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's almost like you wrote Common People, Pulp's Common People from like the perspective of the person in who is the subject of that song.
Yeah. Also, I want to say that they called their band the Dandy Warhols. And then once they had some success and some money, they were like, we should recreate Andy Warhol's factory. And it's like, You already used that for your band name. You can't just keep doing Andy Warhol stuff. You got to find like a different, thing to be doing, which I don't know what happened with that, but they're like, we could build a factory.
I think they still have it and it's sort of an event space. And
They also
started a label and it didn't work out very well.
Really? What was the, what label?
I forget what it was called. But I remember one of the guys from one of the bands they signed was kind of like, yeah, I mean, they're nice people, but like they didn't really do anything. And then Courtney Taylor was like, yeah, we're horrible business people. Like he was like, we don't really know what we were doing and meant well, but like, yeah.
That does seem to be the Dandy Warhol's experience of like, yeah, they seem nice. They seem fine, yeah. But like, I don't know if they have the best business sense. Wait, hold up. Some of the 13 Tales from Urban Bohemia Wikipedia page, they wrote a song called Muhammad and they have one after that called Nietzsche.
Yes.
They have a song called Big Indian. What the fuck is this? And then Get Off is the one where that's the one that's in that skate video.
Oh, okay. I actually listened to this album the other day and I kind of forgotten every single song on it.
Yeah, I just remember Get Off because it was in that. I want to say it was like maybe a Ronnie Krieger part or something. Blind, What If, Ronnie Krieger, Dandy Warhol's the Last High. Okay, then who is Jake Duncombe, the Dandy Warhol's Get Off? Yeah, What If, two parts, they were both two Dandy Warhol songs. Krieger was The Last High, Jake Duncombe was Get Off. But okay. Yeah. Baby, come on, yeah, you got a hard time getting it. That's the one I remember from the video. I don't remember what isn't The Last High like more electronic or something?
Don't remember.
I don't know. Whatever. But yeah, I have not listened to this album. How did you feel revisiting? Is it good? Do you like it?
No. I feel like it was okay, but like, you know, I like I said, like I just kind of forgot, like everything that I heard sort of slipped out of my brain after that.
I tried to listen to their first record, like not like in the past couple of days, but like at one point I tried to listen to their first record where it was like, yeah, this is the good record. And I was just like, I just kind of don't care. But also, I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of a picky music listener. So maybe I'll give like the first record a chance or something at some point, but it just kind of wasn't doing anything for me. And I don't know, the titling, just the whole like 13 Tales, that just, it's really cringy to me. I just can't, like, cause like the worst thing that can happen is like that album's amazing. And then you have to be like, I love 13 Tales of Urban Bohemia. I don't want to live that life. What was the other stuff we wanted to talk about?
I mean, do we want to talk about like what we think of Brian Jonestown Massacre?
Yeah. Much prefer Brian Jonestown Massacre's music.
Yeah.
I haven't listened to every album they've ever done. Some of the more recent stuff I haven't, but you know, pretty much everything from like the start up through like, I don't know, 2010-ish, like all this stuff's pretty solid. I think the worst I can say about some of it is that like probably should have edited a little bit and maybe cut the albums down a little bit, but
yeah,
you know, generally pretty strong. How do you feel about Brian Jonestown output?
Yeah, I also like, I kind of haven't really listened to more recent stuff, but I love their Satanic Majesty's Second Request.
Yeah. Excellent title. Good. Yeah.
I think it kind of takes balls to make that title.
Yeah. And then like later on, Who Killed Sergeant Pepper? They're very much direct about their influences. Yeah. I don't even know what I would pick as my favorite. Cause like,
I also think like great. Having listened to the Dandies recently and Brian Jonestown Massacre recently, I think, Brian Jonestown Massacre is more of a, like an albums band.
Yeah.
I feel like the Dandies are more of a singles band.
Yeah. I mean, Brian Jonestown definitely has a couple songs that are like, they've had a couple songs that have been used as like theme songs on things and a couple that have been like gotten some notoriety from certain reasons, but they're very much not a singles band. Strangely enough, they do a lot of stuff. Cause like the first couple things are, they're kind of like Paisley Underground meets shoegaze. And then at some point they're like, what if we just start trying to make like Brian Jones era Stones music? And then they kind of shift around a little bit, but in a way that is never like, it feels like there's a reverence for the past without being just a nostalgia act. Like, I don't think that zero context, if you put on a Brian Jonestown record, you're not going to actually think it's from the 60s. It doesn't sound like that.
Right.
But it does sound like music from people who very much like that kind of stuff. Yeah, I mean, honestly, they're a great band for like, if you just like want, you're like, I just want to kind of put something on and just have like a good, like, they're a good band for like, if you're working on stuff and you want music in the background and you just kind of want to like put a record on and just have an hour of, you know, yeah, an hour of stuff. Cause they're pretty consistent. I would say that if they have a fault, it's that sometimes the records can be a little samey over the runtime. Yeah. But I think that's also kind of one of the strengths of them, is you can kind of just like, if you like the vibe of that record, you can kind of just like, it just kind of goes. You can
hang in that vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. You can kind of hang out there for like an hour. I don't think I've listened to anything since like Off Have Been or whatever it is past Who Killed Sergeant Pepper, but like everything up till then is like solid. They do shoegazy stuff and they do 60s-y stuff, and they don't have an album called 13 Tales of Urban Bohemia. Which is a benefit from my perspective. But culturally, I feel like they're a lot more relevant right now than the Dandies.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Brian Jones era Rolling Stones?
there could be a whole, we're going to make this whole Brian Jones themed podcast. I mean, Brian Jones era Stones is my favorite era of Stones by far.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
I think
that's not true for most people, but
I don't think it's true. Like, one of my most cancelable takes, I think, is that the Mick Taylor era Stones is a downgrade. And I think that people would get very mad if I say that Exile on Main Street era Stones is not the best era. I think people are very defensive of the like 68 to 73 era Stones.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good stuff in there. However, every Stones record from that time has like, there's some like 10 minute track of like a honky tonk piano starts and Mick Jagger starts singing about like some kind of honky tonk shit, which didn't happen in the Brian Jones era. What I like about Brian Jones was that he was the guitarist who was like, I don't want to play guitar. I'm going to do weird shit. So, yeah. You know, you're going to get sitar. You're going to get whatever the hell I'm doing, which led to it being a lot more.
Well, he was kind of the first guy doing like he is why the Beatles kind of started getting into sitar and stuff.
Yeah, he was definitely a trailblazer in that. And everyone points to him like not really being a great guitarist, which is, you know, technically true. However, he was the first crazy ass white boy in Britain playing slide. Like yeah. for as much as all those guys like the blues, none of them knew how to play slide except for like that was his strength. And when the Stones started and they were a blues cover band, the strength was that Brian Jones could play slide, which fucking nobody else. Clapton never played slide. Keith Richards wasn't playing slide. None of the white boys playing blues in Britain could play slide. Brian Jones could play slide, and everyone was like, "What? How are you doing this? What is this?" Because he was a record nerd who was into all this stuff kind of before everybody else, and he had taught himself Bottleneck, so he could do that. And then he was very much like, "I don't really care about guitar anymore. I'm gonna play saxophone. I'm gonna play sitar. I'm gonna play." You know, marimba, like he's got like, so the Stones mid 60s Stones is, there's a lot of really interesting sonic stuff going on because you have a lot of just weird shit. Like Brian Jones will just be like, I'm going to play bells on this or whatever. Whereas he leaves the band and then they get this very like masculine aggressiveness added to it, which I know Brian Jones is not the most delicate flower, and like they all, like everyone else, everyone at the time, like, you know, he had like domestic violence problems and stuff. But there was kind of like a gentleness he brought to the sound that I think once you got Mick Taylor in as more of like a guitar god kind of guy, and then him and Keith started doing the guitar thing, it just got this like way more masculine, brown sugar, honky tonk. Whatever that honky tonk bar shit they got into was,
yeah.
I don't like it as much as some would say failed psychedelia of like the mid to late 60s Brian Jones era, which I like Her Satanic Majesty's Request, fantastic album. Like I know people say it sucks, but it rules. Like that era of Stones is great. What are your Brian Jones thoughts?
I mean, pretty much the same. Like I appreciate. I like that era. I like how weird he got with it. He was the first kind of crazy ass white boy.
he was a crazy ass white boy. Also, you know the other Stones thing that's been stuck in my head for a while. You know, when in Honky Tonk Women, when he's like, I met a gin-soaked barroom queen in Memphis. It's like, what the fuck are you singing about Memphis for? You're an English band. Why are you singing about Memphis? Like, what? Because I just kept going, Memphis? Like, you're not. Yeah. What the hell?
You're from, should have said in Reading or something.
I met a
gin-soaked
barroom queen in
Leeds.
once the Stones formula solidifies, Keith gets obsessed with open G tuning, takes the sixth string off his guitar, which like everyone's like, oh, that's the Keith Richards thing because you can do riffs with like one finger. And it's like, yeah, but all the Stones riffs kind of turn into being monotonous at that point because he just keeps like, you know, the start me up, that kind of thing is like, that's just like every Stones riff. I don't know. I think that the late 60s, early 70s Stones records are good. But I definitely prefer Brian Jones stuff to them just because this is more interesting to me. And I can only take so much honky tonkin'. And I don't know. I just don't get the whole honky tonk. That's Stones vibe. It's not my thing. And then like, that's when they get like really into like, I don't know. I feel like all their like, I feel like all their more controversial stuff, like Brown Sugar, is like around that era where they're like, they're like, what if we just start singing about stuff we shouldn't?
Which I like, mean, to be fair, the earlier song Under My Thumb is pretty misogynistic.
It's misogynistic, but not in the same way.
But it's a great song.
Yeah. But see, that's also one of those ones, like Under My Thumb, if it was post Brian Jones, wouldn't have had the marimba.
Yeah.
Which is like what makes the song so cool. Yeah. And like Paint It Black with sitar. It was always the Brian Jones stuff. Or Get Off My Cloud, there's a thing that sounds like a guitar, but it's actually a baritone saxophone that Brian Jones is playing.
Yeah.
So it's like he's always doing that kind of stuff. And that's why we have no choice but to stand Brian Jones. And by extension, Brian Jonestown Massacre.
That's right.
Which, also, humorously enough, I found that people will get very pissed off about that name.
Yeah.
Because there were a couple, because I was looking around for info on them just like over the years and stuff and like forum threads. And I found some threads on like some guitar forums and stuff. And like some guys just like will lose their shit over how offensive the name is. So
it doesn't bother me, but I am a ghoul.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with it. I think it's macabre in a amusing way.
Yeah,
and also like, I mean, the Brian Jonestown Massacre like was from San Francisco, like they were like right in that area. So I get it. Like I fully
also
get
I think
it.
It's a really fitting name because I mean that's kind of like Anton is kind of like if you shove together Brian Jones and Jim Jones.
Yeah, he really is. I guess as one final thing, the fighting footage from the documentary, I will say gives you a good amount of watching Anton both fight with his band members, fight with the audience, and fight with everyone who is somehow in the vicinity of the band. What is the one he's like arguing with like the documentary people or something? There's like one point.
Yeah.
Absolutely everybody in his orbit gets yelled at some point. In terms of like quality shit show footage, there's a good amount here.
Yeah, if you love mess.
I think that the most iconic line from this is after the fight where I think the fight where Matt Hollywood quits, they're outside and the camera person goes up to Anton, like, is that blood? He's like, yeah, it's blood. And then, like, he's like, oh, they broke my sitar. He's talking about how his sitar got broken in the scuffle on stage. That's my most memorable line.
Yeah, I really liked it.
What, the documentary?
Yeah.
I think it's definitely worth a watch. It's kind of, I want to say it's kind of under the radar now. I don't think you hear about it very much. But I think that, from what I'm understanding, it's a pretty important for a lot of people finding out about the Brian Jonestown Massacre. Like, I think that there are a lot of people whose introduction to the band was through that documentary.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know if there's a lot of Dandy Warhols fans who found him through that, but it seems to be like a very common thing for Brian Jonestown people to be like, oh, I found out about them through the documentary and then I started listening to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Dandies, most people would know them from the commercial, or like, I know Bohemian Like You was in an episode of Buffy, I think. Like, it's been in some movies, and yeah.
They seem like the kind of band you'd hear in a Buffy episode. That tracks.
And then, like, their other biggest song, We Used to Be Friends, was the theme song for Veronica Mars for a while, so yeah.
This is the whole, there's a whole world of television I'm unfamiliar with, and Veronica Mars and Buffy are in that orbit, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to say that the Boardwalk Empire theme song might be a Brian Jonestown Massacre song.
Oh, really?
Let me check. I remember there.
I did watch Boardwalk Empire, but I don't remember what the theme song was.
Yeah, it's Straight Up and Down.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of people who don't know about the band are like, why is this the theme song for a show that I think is set in like the 20s or something?
It is, yeah.
I've never seen it, but
it's pretty good.
But yeah, supposedly that was a lot of people's intro to hearing about the band was that it was like Boardwalk Empire theme song, which is apparently just in place because the person who made Boardwalk Empire was like, I like this band, let's make that the theme song.
Wow, okay.
Something.
Yeah, and I think like Anemone was Anthony Bourdain's favorite song. So,
oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Bourdain dug him too.
Yeah.
They're kind of like Brian Jones and Massacre is very much like a not the most popular band, but like all of the cool people like them. Like they're kind of that kind of band. They don't get like a ton of mainstream respect, but like, you know, most people like in the know think they're pretty cool. Yeah. Recommended watching. I think that it does a lot of things well as a documentary. I think that it gives you some insight into kind of general, like the tension of working in a creative field of like commerce versus art. I think it gives you that. I think it gives you an interesting insight into the band's working. You see a little bit of like Brian Jones and Massacre in the studio, a little bit of the process. You see some footage of them playing live. You see the spectacle of like Anton fighting with people. You get some reflection from like A&R people and their manager about like, you know, like what could have been and like how hard it was to work with them. There's just kind of like a ton of stuff going on. And I think that it's just one of those ones that I can just put on and enjoy watching it just as a movie. I think that there's, it definitely helps that there's like a bunch of, there's a bunch of Brian Jonestown music throughout, which.
Yeah. I think it's like it's just a good portrait of kind of the music industry in that era.
Yeah. It definitely gives you an insight into that particular, like late 90s, early 2000s, particular brand of quote unquote indie music, even though, kind of stops being indie once you sign to Capitol. But
yeah, but then they basically went back to being indie. So
yeah, then they went back to being indie. So I guess it's all fine in the end. Do you have any other?
I don't think so. I think we covered everything.
All right, so that is it for our episode about Dig. Tune in next time where we talk about some movie that's not Dig.
We haven't decided yet.
Yeah, we definitely have not decided yet. If you want to follow the podcast, you can follow us on Twitter at @turnonyourmonitor. Your is spelled YR. You can also subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts, Spotify, Apple, whatever all the million platforms are that I don't even know about. We're on all of them. So subscribe through whatever method you use. If you want to keep up with anything that we are doing individually, from our Twitter account, you can link to it's got both of our personal accounts in the bio. We both do stuff/make stuff. Jess has an Etsy store with various lino cut prints that you can purchase. Those are cool. There's a lot of bird themed stuff recently, as well as some previous ones of various skulls and moths and things of that nature. I have links to my site on my Twitter, where I've written a bunch of stuff you can read. I've got some chat books and some music I'm working on. I've got a record coming out very soon that I will promo on here when it's ready. But yeah, we do stuff and make stuff, and that is available. Mostly just subscribe to the podcast so you get new episodes whenever they come out. And we will be back in another couple weeks with another documentary about another or other bands that we have currently not decided on yet, but turns out a ton of documentaries about bands. So we can kind of keep going with this for a long time if we want.
Yeah.
turns out there's a documentary about just about every band around. So that's it. Until next time. You broke my sitar, motherfucker.